is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, April 3rd, 2024. And today will be better than yesterday. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home in Montana. Taylor Schwenk is working from the Schwenk Studios back in Connecticut. And he is just beaming because he had a Baltimore Orioles player compliment the hat he was wearing when we taped an interview. That was Grayson Rodriguez, who we spoke with, and you'll hear that later in the podcast. And Taylor, how excited were you? Can you please relate that conversation?
Buster, So here's the deal. So we do the interview. We taped it ahead of time. And as you know, a lot of times we have athletes on, I like to hit stop on the record like immediately. So, you know, maybe sometimes you guys might do a little off the record chat, but I regret it this time because immediately I'm wearing my Orioles, the batting practice hat for 2024. It has the old school bird on it from the 90s. And I love it. It's a great hat. It's not wool. It's got like a synthetic feel to it, whatever. But I wore it for the interview because, you know, I'm an Orioles guy and, you know, I'm a hat guy too. So I take a lot of pride in my headwear.
And he got to know you a little bit because you asked a couple questions in the interview. Mm-hmm, so like I could tell Grayson liked you.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
So that was a great start. I mean, he answered my questions. He was very generous with his time. I thought it was a great interview, but I hit stop and he goes, that hat. I love that hat. We all want to wear that hat on the field. That's the batting practice hat. We love the logo, and we got to get it on during a game here. And so we chatted about it for a minute. But like, for Grayson Rodriguez to compliment my hat, I mean, we're hitting highlights all over the place. We were on TV last week. I'm getting compliments from Orioles players. I mean, this is what a run we're on with the podcast. Good show today, Buster. Good show.
You're breaking new ground. On today's, too, the first time I've ever had an organist on. Dieter Ruhl, an organist for the Los Angeles Dodgers, is going to join us. He's going to talk about sort of his process for picking songs for different players. And he's got an interesting perspective about talking with players and preparing for that. So that's certainly a fun conversation. And Paul Hambakidis will talk to us about some early overreactions that he has to the first games of this season. All right, some news and notes to start today. Rangers third baseman Josh Jung is going to have wrist surgery. He's going to be out at least 6 weeks. Just a devastating blow for the Rangers. He looked like he was off to a great start, comfortable, looked like this was going to be a big breakout year for him, but he got hit by a pitch the other night, and he's going to be out for a long time. This was a surprise. Missouri voters rejected the stadium tax for the Royals and the Chiefs. We talked about this in relation to the Bobby Witt contract that Kansas City doled out during the course of the wintertime. You know, the Royals, along with the Chiefs, are trying to get funding for a new ballpark downtown. But that was all thrown into question Tuesday night when residents of Jackson County, Missouri, resoundingly voted down a sales tax measure that would have helped a new downtown ballpark along with major renovations to Arrowhead Stadium. More than 58% of voters ultimately rejected the plan, which would have replaced an existing 3/8 of a cent sales tax that has been paying for the upkeep of Truman Sports Complex, the home for more than 50 years to Kauffman and Arrowhead Stadiums. Dallas Keuchel signed a minor league contract with the Seattle Mariners. He, of course, won the Cy Young Award in the American League in 2015. Bryce Harper last night had a huge night, 3 homers for his first hits of the season. This was Bryce Harper in the bottom of the 4th inning.
Here's Bryce Harper, and he leads off by swinging and ripping one deep to right. This one's got a chance. It's gone. And Harper, a coming out party tonight against the Reds. His first 2 hits, and they're both home runs. It's 2-1 Phillies.
Scott Fransky, Sports Radio 94 WIP, came up again the bottom of the 7th.
Suter comes set in the 3-2 pitch. Swing and a drive. Well hit up the alley right center field, and it is gone. A grand slam. 3 for number 3 is Bryce Harper with his 3rd home run of the night.
Yeah, and Bryce Harper drove in a career-high 6 runs. He also was robbed of a hit on a great catch in right center field during the course of this game. The Brewers and the Twins and Christian Yelich had a big hit in the bottom of the 3rd.
3-2, this is driven out to center. Back goes Buxton at the track, at the wall. Gone! Christian Yelich, his 2nd blast of the season.
Yeah, from 620 WTMJ. After a 3-2 win, the Brewers remain undefeated early this season. Is that going to be one of the overreactions we get from Hembo? We have to see. Alec Marsh last night at the Kansas City Royals dominated the Baltimore Orioles for 7 innings. Michael Garcia had 3 RBI. Part of that came on this hit.
And a swing and a ball well hit. Deep left field. That's way back, and that's going to be bouncing up against that high fence out there right under the 384 sign. One run is in. Two runs are in as diving in head first to score the third run is Lofton. Vermeen and Lofton both come around on a double off the left field fence.
That from 610 KCSP. Royals win 4-1. Garrett Crochet was excellent pitching the White Sox to a 3-2 win over the Atlanta Braves. He got help from Paul DeJong.
Minter deals, and DeJong hits a towering fly deep left. Duvall back at the barrier. It's gone. They lead again.
You knew it was probably going to go because we saw Ozuna's leave. But, man, did he get on that 1-1 pitch.
That was our friend Len Casper on ESPN 1000. Last night, the Astros had a chance to beat the Blue Jays, and Josh Hader, signed to be their closer during the course of the offseason, came on for the ninth inning. With 2 outs, Davis Schneider batted with a runner on base.
The 1-1. Schneider with a high drive to left field. Way back. McCormick on the track. That ball is gone! Davis Schneider, 2-run home run, and the Blue Jays are on top!
Sportsnet 590, The Fan. And the Dodgers played the Giants in Dodger Stadium last night. The Dodgers got to Logan Webb early in this game. Mookie Betts had a hand in that.
Ahead in the count against Webb, 3-1. The pitch. Mookie swings and drives it deep left center field. Way back and gone! A Mookie moment here on a Tuesday night. And the Dodgers have tied it. Betts with his 1,500th career hit, and it's his 5th home run of the season.
Tim Nevert with that call on the Dodgers radio network. We got really sad news on Tuesday about Larry Lucchino, the former president and CEO of the Boston Red Sox, someone who had been president of the Baltimore Orioles, of the San Diego Padres, passed away at age 78. We're going to be talking later this week on the podcast with Todd Radom about the influence that Larry Lucchino had on fans' experience. He really was a driving force behind Camden Yards. He and Janet Marie Smith making that ballpark back in the early 90s and then having all these teams follow their example going forward. And, man, I got to know Larry a little bit. So we're going to be trading some stories with Todd on Friday's podcast about Larry Lucchino. And on Monday night, Ronel Blanco did this for the Houston Astros.
2-2 to Guerrero. Ground ball tap. Blanco lets it go by. Dubon Fields throws the first in time. A no-hitter! Ronel Blanco! Yainer Diaz, the first to jump into his arms. And the rest of his teammates come out to mob him. Ronel Blanco has thrown the 17th no-hitter in Houston Astros history as the Astros defeat the Toronto Blue Jays 10-0.
That was Robert Ford on KBME with a great call there. What a great story. Ronel Blanco, someone who didn't sign to play professionally until he was 22 years old. He had been a corner infielder. He wound up switching from reliever to starting pitcher because Dana Brown, the incoming general manager last year, encouraged the staff to make him do that. And remember, he was only in the rotation because of a couple of injuries with the Astros this spring. So whatever else you got, Taylor, you can't top that.
No, and we should put a cherry on top of Ronel Blanco's performance there by declaring him the one who got it done on Monday. The ones who get it done is brought to you by Grainger with supplies and solutions for every industry. Grainger has the right product for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Also, Buster, new episodes, I say episodes, of the College Game Day podcast. They're talking college basketball. Pete Thamel and Jeff Borzell has been on there, but Reese wants in the hoop action. So it's Reese and Pete. They're talking hoops, and then they're going to do a separate episode where they're talking a little more NFL draft with my guy Matt Miller, big fan of Americana and folk music. We like to chat about that from time to time. So check those out. The College Game Day podcast, wherever you're listening to this show right now and on YouTube.
And they better be saying the Vikings are going to take a quarterback. That's all I'm going
to
say.
Got to listen to find out.
Jumping into the numbers. This is Hembo Knows on Baseball Tonight.
And Hembo, of course, is Paul Imbecchietti. He's the highest paid researcher in all of America, all the world, with that guaranteed contract we gave him. Hey, what's going on, Hembo?
Buster, I've never been better in my life. I'm not so happy, candidly, with how my Phillies season has begun. They got a nice win on Sunday, so I'm hoping that they'll ease their way into it, as they usually do. But the fact that I just have baseball on my television every single day is all I need. As you know, I'm a sleep early guy. So day baseball in the month of April and May is what I major in. And that's how I'm starting the season, watching every game in the afternoon and enjoying every second that I do.
Well, I'm going to ask you about a moment from the Phillies game the other day. But first, before we do that, let's talk about the no-hitter from Ronel Blanco, whose next start may be on Sunday Night Baseball this weekend against the Texas Rangers. Pretty excited about that. You know, I thought about this. I've just had a lot of conversations with hitters through the years, and they talk about guys being a comfortable 0-for-4, a comfortable 0-for-3. In other words, pitchers who don't look like they're just dominating you. And to me, that's kind of what he was. When I was watching highlights of this, back and seeing the hitters on the other side, there was nothing overwhelming about his stuff. He was mixing in a lot of changeups. He had a good fastball, but not a great fastball. And, you know, I kind of wonder if this is one of those games where the Blue Jays hitters are looking around seventh, eighth inning saying, wait, what? We don't have a hit?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. The stuff is far from overpowering. Basically, what you saw is a bunch of ground balls peppered right into the ground, like easy, soft contact, which is a way in which you can live so long as your infield defense is satisfactory. And I think Houston's will be plenty good enough. But I have to admit, Buster, my biggest reaction from this is not just that the Astros threw their annual no-hitter. It's that if I were a fan of the Toronto Blue Jays, I'd be really, really worried. That was my pervasive takeaway from the performance. I went back and watched a lot of the swings this morning, and a lot of the efforts made were really feeble, not attacking in the right counts, not attacking the right pitches, just kind of a general philosophical dreck through the lineup a few times, which surprises me some because, I mean, by and large, these are professional hitters, veteran hitters that presumably should have at least be able to have a clue the second or third time through the order. And they really didn't. And Buster, I'm going to go back to a prediction that I made last week on the show. And that's that I think the Blue Jays might well be sellers at the trade deadline. As I said before, this is a team with two major pluses in its lineup, in Bo Bichette and Vlad Jr. But I see seven neutrals or minuses across the board. Their first five games, they've only scratched together more than two runs twice. We obviously saw them be no hit by a relative nobody. And it's the process that I really, really, really came away with discouraged by. It's almost as if once they swung and missed on Shohei Ohtani, they had no plan B. This lineup is a problem. And in an American League East that I think is going to be jam-packed with really good run-scoring teams, I don't think the Blue Jays are going to be able to prevent enough runs to make up for the lack of depth in their lineup. What say you?
Yeah, I'd say this too. When, you know, Bo Bichette's out of the lineup, it just feels so thin.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Is out of the lineup. It feels so thin. It feels like an Oakland A's lineup.
It sure does.
No. And where it's just like, man, there's just not a lot of firepower there. And you're not in a good position when you have to rely that much on two guys like that. So I agree with you on that. And, you know, and Ronel Blanco, I just love baseball stories like this. You know, signs at 22 years old as a pitcher, a former corner infielder. He kind of bounces around the minor leagues. And then it was Dana Brown, the general manager, who convinced the minor league staff, look at him as a starting pitcher. And he winds up, you know, having this great moment in the big leagues because a couple of the guys in the Astros projected rotation got hurt, Jose Urquidy and Justin Verlander. And he looks great. I do hope we get him on Sunday Night Baseball this week. All right. I wanted to ask you about a moment in the Phillies game the other day, which I know you're well aware of. For me, what we saw with a pitch that was called a ball, a fastball right down the middle, 98 miles per hour, thrown by Max Fried on a 2-2 pitch. Nick Castellanos, the hitter, takes a step toward the dugout because he knows it's strike three. I mean, it's middle, and it's a ball. And I spent the next 24 hours talking with different people around the game, and I, you know, came to this conclusion I'm feeling pretty confident that the ABS challenge system is going to be in baseball next year. And thank goodness, because the guy that I felt sorry for a little bit in that moment was Bruce Dreckman, the home plate umpire. Like, I know, you know, Bruce, he doesn't want to miss a call like that. And if you get a challenge system, you get these egregious calls in big moments, that would rescue umpires, players from a call like that. What do you think?
Yeah, Buster, I was watching this live, as you might expect, and obviously this is just a case in which he missed one. Like, you're going to get two or three of these a game. You hope they're not in leverage counts. You hope they don't swing the game, but these are games that are being umpired by human beings, and they're far from perfect, and this was an egregious one. This is one in which anyone watching on television could recognize immediately that that would have been it for that at-bat, of course, and it changes the entire complexion of the game. Now, within the context of individual at-bats, especially in even counts, we see close pitches called one way or the other change the outcome of at-bats and thus innings and thus games. And so, you know, this is a case in which it's so blatant for everyone to see. But sometimes when those kinds of things happen, Buster, it goes a long way in telling those who matter, okay, we can't allow something this obvious, something this egregious to recur. And so long as the technology is in a place that we feel comfortable, and I would say based on everything that I've seen, it most definitely is, if it's being used at the professional levels all the way up through where, you know, some of these guys have already experienced this firsthand, well, I'd say this, the challenge system would be perfect. I don't want to reach a place where we're going to completely eliminate the human element from both umpiring and naturally catcher framing, because that's not good for anybody. You lose that sort of interplay and the art and science involved in those things. Buster, I don't want to lose that. That's too much humanity to lose in baseball.
Too invasive.
Too invasive, much too invasive. But the ability for, in my opinion, the hitter or the catcher or the pitcher to immediately challenge, which is what I would want, is in my judgment, a good thing for baseball, especially if there's a limited amount the way that we do in football. I think you'd have to be very selective, of course, with when you do it. But look, all you have to do is watch a minor league game and an Arizona Fall League game to be able to recognize, oh, the technology works great and it doesn't slow baseball down. And if you watch tennis as much as I do, you know that it's a really good thing for that sport to be able to take a quick look and the technology work immediately, and it becomes something that fans enjoy too, and it will thus become part of the culture. I think you have identified this right. If this can happen as soon as next season, it's not obvious to me that there's any real loser here.
And you were right in the way you described the domino effect, you know, and it wasn't only in that rally, but that pretty much had a chance to blow out the Braves bullpen for 3 days,
mm-hmm.
Okay? Because if he gets the proper call there, if he gets a strike three call, 98 miles per hour, right down the middle, the half inning ends, Max Fried comes out for the second inning, and you know how pitchers go. I mean, maybe he settles mm-hmm. down and he winds up throwing five innings. Instead, they're calling on Jesse Chavez right away out of the bullpen. They have to piece together a bullpen game. And you know, I had folks with other teams reaching out to me, said, boy, that's something that, you know, can impact a team for a week. And just, you know, just get, as you say, it doesn't have to be a bunch of calls. Just, I think three per game per team is the way they're doing the minor leagues. And I love that. I hope we take a step toward that. All right. This is the classic time for overreaction to what we've seen so far. So I'm going to throw some topics at you. You actually gave me some heads up ahead of time. What mm-hmm. do you got in the Pittsburgh Pirates lineup?
Buster, the Pirates have the most improved lineup in baseball. That is my first small sample size overreaction. They're averaging 7.8 runs a game in their 5-0 start. Those 39 runs are tied for their most through five games since 1901. All right, we've had a lot of presidents since 1901. And if you just look up and down this lineup, the diversity of skill, the age, the power speed, O'Neill Cruz is going to have a big-time season. We know the tools exist. Brian Reynolds is a nine-figure talent. Brian Hayes has already demonstrated he's a gold glove third baseman and I think has the track record or at least the aptitude to be a plus bat. Jack Suwinski has big-time power, like 30, 35, 40 home run power. And Henry Davis was the first pick in the country. He's in his natural position. I love what I've seen from that guy this spring. I love it. You consider the fact that these guys are going to play an NL Central schedule. You know, nearly a third of their games are coming against arguably the weakest division in the entire league. Buster, it's not obvious to me that we should be dismissive of the Pittsburgh Pirates having a chance. And you gotta keep in mind, like, this is not a club that's going from 55 wins. I mean, this club was in the mid 70s last year, so they don't have to make this kind of like cataclysmic, rare year over year jump. They have to improve in the margin. Some of their young players just have to take a step up. I think the nail in the coffin potentially here for this team might well wind up being the number one pick in the country, Paul Skeens coming up and making 20 or 25 starts for them. Because if they can prevent runs naturally, and if they're going to improve their from a run scoring standpoint the way that I expect, Buster, you might be looking at a team that's playing meaningful games in the middle to late of September. What do you think?
I'm thinking that if you had gotten us that first five games of Pirates sample size earlier, then you might have made that your bold prediction last week. You picked the Pirates to win the division.
That maybe so. Dude, I mean, look, it's one thing to do it against, obviously, the Marlins and the Nationals, but these are still big league teams. I'm not a big fan of besmirching the opponents when you're going out there and you're dominating. And they're going out there and they're dominating. This club looks totally different than it did a year ago. And when you have the ability for young players to take steps, those are the teams that, especially in baseball's climate today, are worth betting on. We saw the Reds do it last year by taking a big step forward. This year could definitely be the Pirates' chance to take a big step forward and be in the playoff picture. I could see it. I could really see it.
What's your early view of the Red Sox rotation?
I think the Red Sox, the Boston Red Sox, could have a top five starting rotation in the American League. A week ago, if you had asked me about the Boston Red Sox rotation, I would have said, oh yeah, that's a big liability. Well, we've had the chance to see them one time so far through the rotation. Bello, Pivetta, Crawford, Whitlock, and Houck. All five of those guys got at least 15 outs. They all allow two or fewer runs with a 170, 194, 260 slash. Now look, I grant you, at the back of the baseball card here across the board, not so impressive. And the injury to Lucas Giolito might well wind up being their undoing. But you and I both know that Craig Breslow, their new general manager, although I'm not exactly sure how powerful he is, but their new general manager is highly regarded and well-respected in the industry, Buster, for his pitching clout. And the fact that he was hired in that role tells me the Red Sox want to major in run prevention. That's what they're focusing on. It's what Chaim Bloom failed. I have not had the chance to dig into the analytics yet to say if this group of starting pitchers is attacking hitters differently year over year. It would not at all surprise me if, let's say, 2 or 3 weeks from now, when we have enough of a sample size, if we learn that they are attacking hitters differently, whether it be pitch profile or location or some combination thereof. But you're going to get that kind of consistency, 1 through 5. Look, any team would sign up for that, especially when you look around baseball and I see every single team in baseball, you could say, yeah, they've got questions when it comes to their starting rotation. These five guys all the way through the first time through, threw the ball really, really well. I don't expect to continue to this extent, but it was really encouraging one time through the rotation.
One of the big acquisitions of the offseason under the radar was Andrew Bailey coming over the Red Sox to be their pitching coach. He's someone who, as he's talked about this spring, focuses on the use of a fastball. And I think that's what we're seeing. I remember talking to Alex Cora, you know, midway through March. And I'm like, how's it going so far? And he talked about Houck and he talked about Whitlock and how good they looked. And, you know, so we'll see. And if they miss the playoffs by 1 or 2 games, it's totally on ownership.
Oh,
but
yeah.
They didn't step up and do more for this team. All right, Bobby Witt Jr., off to a good start.
Buster, Bobby Witt Jr. is going to be an MVP finalist in the American League. Top three. Bobby Witt Jr. is going to finish top three. I couldn't quite get myself to a place where I'm going to pick him to win the MVP because, of course, he's in the same league as Juan Soto and in the same league as Aaron Judge. But, Buster, feast your eyes on this. Bobby Witt Jr. has played 81 games, exactly half a season since July 1st of last season when he really started to kind of kick it into gear, you might say. In those 81 games, he scored 59 runs and driven in 59 runs. He has got 47 extra base hits, 20 of which are home runs, plus 27 stolen bases with a 319, 361, 608 slash line. That's a 969 OPS. With 4.7 wins above replacement among all position players in the sport. Among all position players in both leagues, Mookie Betts is the only one to produce more value since July of last year than Bobby Witt Jr. This is a profile, Buster, to dream on. We know the talent is oozing. The rookie year was a tad bit concerning. The second year, he made meaningful strides in meaningful ways, not just in terms of his sort of April through September stuff, but he built during the year in ways that young players have a tough time doing because he has the ability, the athleticism to adjust. Well, he's picked up right where he's left off. You're not going to find many players that have legitimate 40-40 potential, but he does. And if his swing decisions are going to continue to improve the way that they are, and he's going to continue to improve his defense the way that it is, there is no obvious reason, Buster, why Bobby Witt Jr. cannot finish in the top three in American League MVP voting.
Yeah, and I love the fact that Royals fans know that he's going to be there for a long time, having locked down that contract, which I thought was a really great show of faith from an ownership group that's asking fans to fund a new ballpark. And it was smart all the way around. All right. I had fun yesterday. I know you did too, watching Shota Imanaga pitching for the Chicago Cubs. What was your takeaway?
My takeaway is that he's going to win the National League Rookie of the Year, Buster. You can get him right now at ESPN Bet at 8.5 to 1. I was really impressed. I watched every pitch of the outing. Again, against the Rockies. But even so, 6 innings, 2 hits, no earned, no walks, and 9 strikeouts. He did not allow his first hit until the 6th inning with 2 outs. What I basically saw was a 3-pitch mix. The 4-seam fastball, the splitter, and the sweeper. But Buster, you saw it just like I did. That splitty is absolute money. He threw 24 of those splitties. Of those 24 pitches, the Rockies swung at 15 of them. They missed 12 of the 15. We're talking about a dominant potential put-away pitch. Granted, the league will, you know, most definitely catch up once they have the opportunity to see it once or twice. But you've probably heard this before, but when you go through the numbers, just league-wide, the splitty is the most difficult pitch to hit. Like, if you just break down every single pitch and the outcomes of those pitches, the splitty league-wide is the most difficult pitch to hit. And this guy's got a great one with really, really good control. He can spot it at the bottom of the zone, which is rare because he can also bury it. You know, like he has the ability to use it, to tunnel it, to use it as a ball to a strike, and also as a strike to a strike to freeze a hitter in addition to the swing over. That's what's most encouraging. That guy is an absolute stud. I have no idea if he's going to be able to demonstrate like ace stuff, you know, for 32 starts this year. But based upon just one start, he already demonstrated to me that he has a legitimate, like, first division put-away pitch that's not going to really be easy to contend with, even if you know that it's coming, because it is splitty and because he can use it in 2 ways. What say you?
I say he's a perfect match for the Cubs' infield defense, which is excellent. You know, agreed, to have essentially a soft-throwing left like that. And I love the pitch with yesterday. You got a 30-second bonus question. Who's the worst team in baseball, the Colorado Rockies or the Oakland Athletics?
Yes.
5 errors in the four innings in the game on Monday night.
The answer to this question is going to have to be the Oakland Athletics. And I think the answer is going to have to be the Oakland Athletics because no one's going to watch. Like, I'm going to at some point go through the attendance numbers and demonstrate how they're breaking all sorts of records. At least if you're a fan of the Rockies, you can go to the ballpark. You can get a nice, fresh Coors Light. And maybe if you're lucky, you can watch Nolan Jones and Chris Bryant hit a ball to the warning track. But if you're an A's fan, you're not even going to be sure that if you take a piss, you know, it's going to wind up in the right spot. Okay, that's the worst place to watch a game and no one's going to actually go and watch the game. So I'm going to break the tie, Buster, in a crude manner and say the A's are the worst team. Let's see if Taylor evaporates this from the podcast.
Taylor, what do you got?
Consider it gone.
Fair all right, Hembo.
I'm a good Christian boy. Don't tell my mom. Later, guys.
Get out of here, Hembo. Sick of Hembo. Right.
Grayson Rodriguez pitches for the Baltimore Orioles in his first start this season against the Angels. He allowed 1 run over 6 innings, striking out 9. Grayson, how you doing?
I'm good. How are y'all today?
Doing great. So I'm curious, you're following you know, a guy who's pretty accomplished in the Orioles rotation in Corbin Burnes. When you watched him make that first start, tell me what you are processing, what you're learning from what he's doing, what you're taking away with his approach to specific hitters.
Yeah, he was dominant. I think we can kind of start there, like just kind of seeing him, you know. Obviously got to see him in spring training, but man, like opening day, you know, he kind of flipped a switch. You know, you could tell it was something different. And just like the way, you know, he kind of showed up to the ballpark, you know, there was a whole bunch of stuff like where you could tell, like, you know, this guy's about to go out there and throw the ball pretty well. So it was a lot of fun to watch, obviously. I think he punched out 11 or 12.
11.
Yeah, 6 innings. I mean, like, he was just cruising. And he retired, I don't know, it was like at least maybe 12 or 13 at one point in a row. I don't know. But, man, he was, like, in cruise mode. And it was just, he was throwing the ball where he wanted. And kind of seeing him attack the strike zone was on a different level.
So was he different before the game than you had seen in spring training? Was it like you could see like, oh, boy, the light turned on here?
Yeah, I mean, you could definitely tell that he was more locked in. I think that kind of goes for every starter. You know, like spring training, you know, obviously the games don't matter, you know, but you're trying to get your work in. And sometimes that can be hard. But, like, you know, once you get to the season – I mean, it's full go, and everybody shows up to the ballpark ready to go to work and extremely dialed in, and that's what he was.
How much of use was that for you in terms of the, you know, watching how he threw to particular hitters?
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, kind of you know, sets the tone, I guess. You know, how he kind of pitches different hitters, I guess, you know, can be how I can attack him in some ways, which, you know, we throw different fastballs. His fastball is more cutter-ish, or is a cutter, and yeah. I throw a four seam that can run a little bit. So, but in terms of, like, you know, being aggressive with hitters, to kind of what quadrant of the plate, we can look at a lot of similarities for him and myself.
So in watching your start, the first thing that jumped out to me was the changeup that you were throwing that day. And I felt vindicated because a little while after I think I tweeted out something about your changeup, then Pitching Ninjas chimed in too with a video of your changeup that you were throwing against Aaron Hicks. Tell me about that development of that pitch for you, because it was a weapon the other day.
Yeah, so I guess when I was drafted in 2018, I really wasn't throwing a changeup. Like, coming out of high school, it was fastball and spin, curveball and slider. In high school, I had thrown a splitter at sometimes, but was pretty wild and inconsistent with that pitch. And then when I was, like I said, when I was drafted in 2018, in my first rookie year with the Orioles, and used to be called GCL. Now I think it's the Florida Complex League. The pitching coach there, they were like, yeah, you know, we kind of want you to learn how to throw a changeup. That could be an important piece, you know, of your repertoire. So I was like, all right. So I went home, you know, and was fortunate enough that Josh Tomlin works out at my facility. And so, you know, I was telling him, I was like, the Orioles want me to throw a changeup. And so he was basically telling me and explaining to me how a circle changeup works and how it should spin at like 3 o'clock axis to get the best movement and everything, which I had no idea about. And so I was able to work with him. Came back for the 2019 season in low A and started throwing it in games and actually got really good results with it and was able to make it better. And I was pronating it so much, at times it looked like a screwball.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't get the best, like, movement from that. So I was able to get it down to 230, 245, 3 o'clock, and get the best movement. And then ever since then, I kind of ran away with it and have just been able to work on it over the years. And you know, now it's a pitch that I'm really comfortable throwing in any count.
Yeah, so Josh is one of the best guys in baseball. Like, he is such a good dude, and I'm sure he's someone who really helped. And after the outing, did you get any feedback? Did you hear from him, you know, about the changeup? I'm curious.
No, I usually talk to him before the next start, so I'm sure I'll be talking to him here pretty soon. But, no, I mean, right now, you know, whenever I want to bounce some stuff off of him, I can. But I try to leave him alone as well. So we have a pretty good relationship with him, because now our pitching coach, Drew French, who was in Atlanta at the time Tomlin was there. So they're pretty good friends. And, you know, it's a lot of fun we have in the clubhouse. So that's for sure.
When you throw that changeup, I'm curious about, you know, what you use to assess it. Can you see it with your own eyes, the movement, you know, right away? Or do you sort of go off how the hitter reacts to it? Or is it something where you'll check data in between innings?
Just kind of seeing what the hitter's reaction to it is. You know, I can feel when I throw a good one, or you know, as a pitcher, you know, when you throw a good one.
Yeah.
But really, that's kind of like for the hitters to let you know, whether or not they're seeing it well that day or not. But thankfully, you know, Saturday it was starting at middle, bottom of the zone and just kind of letting it break down out of the zone. That was working really well for us, and we were able to keep doing that. And, you know, it really, you know, got me through six innings. So it was a big piece to that start.
What are your hopes for this season coming off of last year? What did you learn from last year that you're going to build on this year?
Yeah, I think the main thing that we learned last year was, like, just what a playoff game is like, what a playoff atmosphere is. You know, there hadn't been a lot of guys on this team that have been in the playoffs before, and seeing that was completely different. I mean, it was completely different from any kind of regular season game. You know, it was fun. Obviously getting swept was, you know, a punch in the mouth. And I think guys are really hungry. Like, you know, we absolutely just hated how the season ended, and I think we're really eager for this one. And, you know, to get back to the postseason, I think we're going to be a lot more experienced and a lot more, I guess, prepared this time. And so we're pretty excited to see, you know, what we're going to do this year in 2024.
You know, you were talking about Corbin Burns, you know, on opening day, sort of having the game face on. I felt like the Rangers throughout the entire playoffs last year, watching them go about their business, you know, from Marcus Semien to Corey Seager, that's something that seemed to work with them. And they, you know, go 11-0 on the road in postseason games.
Yeah, no, that was impressive for sure. Obviously, they had beaten the Rays right before they came to our place. And, yeah, I mean, they were just – had the bats working. They were super hot. Obviously, it's pretty hard to get them out. I think there was some stat about them not getting the two strikes or something kind of crazy. Like, it was hard to just, you know, kind of get them down. And, you know, felt like that they were always ahead in the count. And, you know, it obviously put them in the World Series and they won it. But, yeah, I mean, it was a pretty incredible team. And there were a lot of guys that were hard to get out.
What's your team like to play on? Because from the outside looking in, it seems like a really positive group where there's a lot of support among you.
Yeah, I would say it's the most fun clubhouse in baseball. I mean, we're a very tight-knit group. I think a lot of, you know, I had the chance to come up through the minor leagues with a lot of these guys, like Adley, Gunner, Jordan Westberg. Like, so many of these guys, like, we grew up, you know, or came up through the minor league system with. And then, of course, you know, guys are already there, like Santander, Hayes, Cedric. Like, you know, it's a very, like, close group, and we really like to have fun. You know, I think Brandon Hyde does a really good job of, like, letting us, you know, just kind of do our own thing and, like I said, have a really fun clubhouse. And so it's pretty fun to show up to the ballpark every day, and I think it makes everybody better because it's a relaxed atmosphere, and we know we're going to have a good chance to go out and win a game.
All right. Our producer here, Taylor Schwenk, is maybe the biggest Orioles fan in the world. He's always talking up the O's. He wears the hat every time we do the show. So I'm going to let him ask a couple of questions. Taylor, go ahead.
Grayson, my guy, thank you for joining us. I have seen that you have a menu item named after you at Jimmy's Seafood, the G-Rod. That's a sushi roll that has shrimp, spicy salmon, cream cheese, asparagus, spicy mayo, and sriracha. How did that come about? Was that your creation? Did you tell them those ingredients, or did you go to, like, a testing? They put a couple things in front of you. How does that come together?
Yeah, so, I mean, going back to Jimmy's, that was in 2018, went to eat there for the first time, and then I've been really good friends with John, the owner, ever since. And I think it was last year, maybe two seasons ago, they came out with the Gunner Burger. And So we would always go eat there. And I would always kind of mess with them, like, John, what? The Gunner Burger. I'm not going to order that. I need something. so they didn't mention anything about it. They had asked me last year. They were like, you know, what do you like in a sushi roll? And I was like, I love salmon. And so they were like, well, what about everything else? I was like, he's like, you can just kind of make whatever. I said, because I like everything. And so the day that I pitched Saturday, that's when they, like, kind of released it, like, publicly. And it was pretty cool. I'm not going to lie. And then went to go eat there after the game and try it out. And I liked it a lot.
Oh, man, I love that. Celebratory G-Rod after the big outing. That's so cool. I saw on Instagram you got married over the offseason. First of all, congratulations. And I saw I'm a man who doesn't really like to dress up. I think, you know, comfort over appearance is key. And I noticed you wore jeans to your wedding, which I thought was awesome. How did that conversation go with the wife? Was there any pushback from her, anyone in the family? I thought you looked sharp and your bride looked stunning. But how did that come about?
No, that was all her. So I told her that she could pick everything. And, you know, most country weddings, it's blue jeans. So blue jeans and boots, and that's what we did. So we got married. I'm from the oldest town in Texas, Snacogdoches. Pretty hard to spell, but there's a really nice venue there that we know the people that own it, and it was just a very nice country wedding, I guess. And, you know, we had a lot of fun, and obviously that's what everybody brings up is the blue jeans and stuff. And they're like, "How'd you get to wear them?" I'm like, "Well, she told me that that's what I was wearing." So you know, it's pretty easy to decide.
Yeah, Grayson. So you had blue jeans at your wedding. Mike Trout had a snowstorm at his wedding, and a snowball fight broke out with all the major league players there. And it was all fun and games until his bride got hit with a snowball. Then it kind of, at that point, then everything kind of shut down. Well, yeah, I appreciate it. Go ahead.
I said, yeah, that could be bad.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. Thanks so much for joining us, Grayson.
Yeah, thank you all very much for having me.
Dieter Rule plays the organ at Dodger Stadium, and I bumped into him the other day at the ballpark and asked him if he would come on because I have so many questions. Hey. Dieter, thanks for doing this.
Hey, Buster. Thanks for having me.
All right. So before we got started today, you mentioned that you have a story about Larry Lucchino, who I talked about at the top of the show. You know, really an important figure in baseball history because he helped us shape fan experience. You know, he was the one, along with Jana Marie Smith, who, you know, fashioned Camden Yards and the design of that. But you got to know him some in San Diego when you worked, you played the organ for Padres games. I wasn't aware that you had done that. So well, tell me the story of you know, Larry Lucchino and someone that you bumped into while you were doing your work.
Yeah. Well, I briefly played the organ for the Padres back in 1998. I made the long drive from L.A. back to San Diego. And so the organ in those days, this was at Qualcomm Stadium. The organ was situated behind home plate. So it was very busy. People would walk through, and Larry would walk by on occasion, say hello. He was really nice. But what I also remember about playing the organ in those days in San Diego, the organ was located behind home plate, right next to where the radar gun was held. And if you go back and watch like Mark McGwire at Padres in 98, when the Cardinals would come in during the whole McGwire time, if you zoom in closely, right to the shot from center field, you'd see people sitting behind home plate. You'd see a guy with the radar gun, and to his left was the organ. You see my head over the body of the organ. But the guy holding the radar gun was Theo Epstein. So Theo and I would talk between innings sometimes when I wasn't playing. But that's my memory of San Diego. It was brief. I did about half the games that year. It was a long drive, you know, LA to San Diego. But yeah, Larry was really nice. He'd always, you know, say hello and how you doing.
Yeah, and when he moved to the Boston Red Sox, of course, and they tried to hire Billy Beane to be their general manager, and that didn't work out. Then they turned to the youngest general manager in baseball history in Theo. And yeah. I think that worked out well for the Red Sox. Yeah. So tell me, you mentioned about working for the Padres briefly. How did you wind up working for the Dodgers?
Back in 2013, the Dodgers reached out to me. Their organist at the time, Nancy B. Heffley, was going to miss some games that season. And I was working at Staples Center doing Kings and Lakers games. And so they wanted to know if I would be available to substitute, to fill in for Nancy B when she would miss. So I did. I covered for her in 2013 and 2014, 2015. Then she retired after 2015. Once she retired, they asked if I was interested. And then I said, of course, I would love to do it. And if I can add, my first game in 2013 filling in was the bench clearing brawl between the Dodgers and the Diamondbacks. And Puig was on the team. I think Kirk Gibson was.
Man, that was a nasty fight, too.
Yeah, that was my first game on the organ, filling in at the Dodgers.
Nice. How did you handle that? The background for that in terms of what you would play? Is something like that's going on?
On one hand, I wanted to lay out. On the other hand, maybe because of my history playing at hockey games, I thought maybe I could play the theme to Rocky, Gonna Fly Now. And I played it a little bit. I played it briefly, and some of the writers noticed it. And that's not Nancy B. That's there. Yeah.
So are you a big sports fan? You obviously, with the work that you do, you're around sports all the time. But, you know, Bob Shepard, who you remember as being the voice of the Yankees, you know, had that distinctive voice. In between batters, he would read a book. He wasn't really Bob, who I got to know through the years covering the Yankees. He wasn't really that interested in it. And when it came time to announce, a hitter's name, he would do that. But for you, are you a big sports fan?
I am. I'm fortunate to say I was able to meet Bob. I met Bob Shepard in 06 at Yankee Stadium. And you're right. He had a book he'd read. But I born and raised in L.A., grew up a big Dodgers fan. And I remember those World Series back in 77, 78. And I was that nerdy kid who would hear background stuff. So I would hear Eddie Layton on the organ at Yankee Stadium, and I would hear Bob Shepard in his unique style. So to meet him in 06 was a big thrill for me. So, yeah, I'm a big sports fan.
Nice. Who was your player? And you don't know this. I was a huge Dodger fan growing up as a kid. And I grew up in Vermont. Whenever they would come, he said, listen to games on the radio. you know, and so what, you know, they played the Phillies and the Pirates. I listened to their games, but those guys on that team, that infield, you know, Say, Russell, Lopes, Garvey, you know, that was my sweet spot as a developing sports fan. So yeah. I think we watched a lot of the same teams to the point that later on when I covered the Yankees for the New York Times, when I met Reggie Jackson for the first time, there was a voice in the back of my head, and I have the same nightmares that I did Jackson from the 78 World Series. I was thinking, oh my God, I used to hate you so much as a kid, yeah. You know, as a Dodgers fan. Yeah. You know, who were your guys, the players you rooted for growing up?
Yeah, Bill Russell. You mentioned Garvey, Lopes, Russell, Say, but it was Bill Russell. But it was the whole team, you know, Steve Yeager, Dusty Baker, Reggie Smith, Doug Rao, Rick Roden, Bob Welch. So yeah, I was a big fan. And then, of course, was it 77 or 78 when Reggie was between first and second and Bill Russell was throwing back to Garvey and Reggie kind of stuck his butt out?
Yes.
Yeah.
78, he cheated.
78.
I can run you through all the specifics of that. I'm still bitter about that play.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me this. This surprised me the other day when you and I were chatting, and I asked you, well, you know, do you get a chance to get much feedback? Do you talk from players? Do you talk to players directly about your work? And you mentioned that didn't happen very often. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it doesn't happen very often because I stay up in the press box and they're down, you know, field level, obviously. Once I made it down because one of the executives said that Dave Roberts wanted to talk to me. I'm like, oh. But I just accompanied his daughter. She sang the national anthem the day before. So I went down along the dugout railing, and Dave Roberts came right up to me. I don't know how he knew what I looked like, but he shook my hand. He goes, great job. Thanks for accompanying my daughter. Long story short, I ended up talking with Justin Turner. And this was about, I don't know, 2017, 2018. And Justin Turner, oh my God, he was so nice to me. And he's like, when he was out there playing third base, he would tell me he was hoping he would enjoy if the ball would be hit to, say, Kike Hernandez. Because what I do in those situations is like a routine grounder, a routine pop-up. I will play their walk-up song on the organ. So I think Kike's song was Passion Fruit by Drake. So the ball would be hit to him, I'd play it on the organ. But just knowing that Justin Turner actually heard that, like, I didn't think the players would be hearing that stuff, but that was pretty cool. But yeah, I don't really have much interaction with them though, with the players.
And you keep your distance because you think, what's the reason for that?
I don't know. It's like, I'm upstairs, they're down there doing their prep, and I'm actually upstairs doing my prep. So it's my version of batting practice while they're doing theirs. I don't know if I would have even gone down if I hadn't been told Dave Roberts wanted to speak with me. So I don't know, maybe I should do it more often. I don't know.
So tell me about the prep that you do in terms of trying to think of what works for different players. When you and I talked the other day, for example, you know, I asked you about Otani and we talked a little bit about Yamamoto. Tell me about how you think of how you want to accompany these players.
I know each player is different. I just try to make it fun for the fans. And if there's some sort of link, like recently with Otani, I just figured maybe I could just play some Japanese anime songs that might be recognized by Otani fans. So I've been doing that recently. I played Sailor Moon. I recently learned Jujutsu Kaisen, played that last night. But I don't know, I just try to be prepared. You know, I'll make a playlist. But then stuff just comes to me, like in-game. Like a few years ago, I started playing Right Down the Line. If there's a ball that's just foul, I play stuff for, like, if the count's 2-2, two outs. Like Vin Scully used to say, deuce is wild, right? But right. I play the theme to Twin Peaks or Room 222, which is an old show from the late 60s.
Oh, yeah.
70s. But the scoreboard reads 2-2-2. So I figured Room 222. Hopefully it just brings a smile to whoever's noticing it.
Give me what you feel like are some moments when you're like, man, you know, that it felt perfect what you came up with in the moment where you're like, boy, that fit.
Gee, I'm stumped.
Or you had fun with one, you know, or something. You mentioned it fun and you know, maybe fans responded in a moment.
wow, I'm stumped. There's so many. I mean, like I mentioned, just the literal stuff. Whether there's a foul ball, a batter is staying alive. Like it's three balls, two strikes, and however many outs. 8, 9, 10 fouls in a row, and I might do a little riff of the Bee Gees, staying alive. Just little things like that. I have fun with it. And sometimes I just amuse myself. Maybe nobody else will get it.
Yeah. Oh, I think I do. I love seeing the tweets from some of the Dodger writers responding to what you're playing. About your interactions with fans when they meet you, some of the fun ones that you've had.
I was flattered. I mean, I'm not a player, but yet sometimes people will like, they'll like, oh, can we have a picture with you? Or can you sign this? And I'm like, sure, you know. No, the fans have been, there's a lot of love there. I really appreciate it. Like you mentioned on Twitter, people just, you know, but give me compliments and I feel fortunate. It's going really well.
What's the a game that you love to watch that really stuck with you while you were playing?
I think it was game 3 of the 2018 World Series against the Red Sox. I think it was the longest game in World Series history.
18 innings. Yep.
Yeah. Over 7 hours. And we were in the 13th inning and the Red Sox took the lead. And I was like, no, because I wanted to get to the 14th inning to play Take Me Out to the Ball Game again, you know?
Right.
And so the only way that was going to happen is if the Dodgers would tie the game. And so they tied the game in the bottom of the 13th. Oh, we're going to the 14th. Yay. You know, so I get to do it in the World Series. You know, that was cool. And it was long, you know, 7 hour plus game. And then to win it, I think it was Max Muncy hit the home run. Max Muncy.
Yeah.
Pointing to the shirt here. That one stands out. But it was also heartbreaking to lose the World Series at home in 2017. Especially and in 20, the Dodgers had such good teams those years, and to see the other team celebrate on our field, it's tough, you know. But I get it. I mean, that's part of the ride, you know. You win some, you lose some.
So as you know, in 2020, pandemic year, that's when the Dodgers won the World Series. You know, you didn't have an opportunity to be there when they won that World Series. I'm assuming, right?
Right. The MLB requested that I send some recordings. So I ended up sending some recordings from the Oregon and Dodger Stadium, and they were played. So people were asking, is that you? And I said, no, they were just some recordings of me.
What have you thought about what you would play if the Dodgers win the World Series?
Well, we have all sorts of celebratory music, but I think the obvious would be Queen. You know, We Are the Champions.
Yeah. I asked you that question. One of the cool memories from when I was a kid growing up in New England, when Carlton Fisk hit the home run, you know, where he hits the foul pole with a home run to end game 6 of that World Series, Hallelujah, they played on the organ at Fenway Park. And, you know, you wondered how that decision was made sort of in the spur of the moment. Because I suspect that's a lot of what you're doing is just reacting and feeling the game and what, you know, what your own response is.
True. I do prep. I do a little playlist, but then at the end of the day, it's like a good chunk of what I've played just came to me in the moment. So yeah, you just never know. You just have to try to be prepared, you know, and I practice as often as I can. And that's when ideas come to me when I'm home practicing. It's like magic. Like, oh, I could do this for that situation. So yeah, you never know. So you got to be ready, you know.
All right, Dieter. Well, I appreciate you coming on. It's a fun conversation. It was fun to bump into you the other day.
Thanks for having me. It's fun bumping into you too.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for a Wednesday. We got some voicemails. We got some tweets. Let's start with the voicemails here.
Hey guys, this is Landon from Atlanta. Buster, do you think from a statistical standpoint, we as baseball fans undervalue the impact one player can have on the overall success or failure of a team? After listening to David Cone's analysis on the way Juan Soto has changed the culture of the Yankees and hearing your analysis of how Corey Seager changed the Rangers last year, I really am starting to think that one player can have a massive impact on the success or failure of a team. I would love to hear your thoughts on this. Thank you.
Landon, I think it's got to be the right player, right? Like, I really feel like, Taylor, we'll look at your Orioles. I really think that when Adley Rutschman arrived, it changed so much for that team. And to me, he's like the right personality. Like, he's the right position. He's a leader of the pitching staff. And it's not only about, you know, he's a good offensive player, a switch-hitting catcher, but it's just the daily positivity that he has. I do think that guy can make a difference. Look, when I covered the Yankees back in the late 90s, you know, Derek Jeter was a great player, but I think beyond that, and I wrote about this in the book that I did on them, I think that his confidence really rubbed off on the other players and sort of pushed them from day to day. He always ran out every ball. He was invested in every plate appearance in every game. And I think that made a difference. So I think if you have the right player, yes, absolutely. Taylor, what do you think?
I totally agree with you. Amongst Orioles fans, we always have the conversation, who's better, Gunner or Adley? And I think the distinction is Adley is the most important player on the Orioles. Gunner might be the best player. So there is a difference there. And I think Adley's, like, his win percentage when he's played for the Orioles, it's something ridiculous, like 700.
Yeah.
Like, it's crazy. So I think there is something to it, but it's got to be the right guy. Let's go to the next one.
Hey, Buster and Taylor. So for the first time in my life, the Pirates are 5-0. So my question is, what does Pittsburgh need to do in order to ensure that they make the playoffs and capitalize on this great run? Please don't say trade your three best prospects for a declining pitcher like they did in 2018 with Chris Archer. Love the show. Thanks for taking my question.
Yeah, and I think that was something that was pushed by the team president at the time. I don't think that was something that the front office necessarily wanted to do. Look, how about this? Promote one of the best pitchers in the organization, Paul Skenes, to the big leagues. I think that's a good start, right? It looks like they have a nice core of players. Have you heard Hembo raving about the everyday lineup that they have? I just think you use the resources you have for now. I think Paul Skenes is one of their best pitchers, so promote him.
Jake Peavy would agree. Let's go to the next voicemail.
Hi, this is Riv, short for River City from Cincinnati. And this is not an April Fool's joke. What does the team have to do to get attention? I mean, I just heard the highlights from Sunday night, and it just triggered me because that was a fantastic walk-off of the Reds. Christian Encarnacion Strand capped it off. It was big. Thank you for listening.
All right, Rib. Thank you for the feedback. I will say, you know, we can't really do, from a practical standpoint, we can't really do highlights of 15 games. It just would take too long. But with the walk-off, I agree with the benefit of 2020 hindsight. That would have been a good one, Taylor, don't you think?
Absolutely. Sorry, Riv. We'll be more respectful of the Reds.
We do. We try to spread it out. We try to spread out the love. That's when when Hembo today sent me, you know, possible topics, I'm like, let's talk Pirates. You know, let's talk about Bobby Witt Jr. Let's spread the love a little bit and not just talk only about Ohtani and the Dodgers and the Yankees.
And here we are. We got a Pirates voicemail. We got a Reds voicemail, and we're going to close it out with a Twins voicemail right here.
Buster, Taylor, this is Nick in Baltimore, diehard Twins fan, actually. I was the one that originally tweeted you last year about that Luis Arraez is Tony Gwynn 2.0. You put me in my place pretty thoroughly with all the stats to the table, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Certainly not making the comparison of them career-wise, but I think stylistically they're somewhat similar. And now we'll say that we are certainly missing Luis in Twin territory these days. I'm just curious to get your thoughts on where the Twins are, where they stand and how they're going to be able to hold up over the next month to 6 weeks or so without both Duran and Lewis in the lineup. So love the show. Take care. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I remember that. That was a fun conversation, man. I just feel bad for guys like Royce Lewis, you know, like you just get excited. He had such a great finish to last year. He's a weapon. I mentioned, I saw him in spring training. A really good dude, and right away he gets a quad strain, and it kind of broke your heart. You know, here's the reality. If you're in the American League Central, it's just so forgiving. You know, do I think the Tigers are going to run away with it? No. Do I think the Royals are going to run away with it? No. Cleveland is off with a good start. I think the Twins have too many good players, and they'll hang in there. But, man, it could be a push. And here's something to think about, by the way, about Luis Arraez. Maybe get Luis Arraez 2.0 with the Twins, Because I think when you're, you know, you see what's going on with with Miami early this season, they're going to be sellers at the deadline. And Luis Arraez would be an interesting guy to throw out in the trade market.
That is a great call, Buster. Let's do two tweets here. Let's give some love to the tweeters. PK writes in, I was going to submit a Bleacher tweet about Bryce Harper's slow start, but decided not to. Glad I hesitated. Pat Johnson follows Johnston. Sorry, forgot the T, Pat. Pat Johnston says, scale of 1 to 10, how worried should I be about the Phillies bullpen? Early returns are not great, and Bryce Harper can't hit 3 home runs every night. Or can he?
Yeah, I think the... both with the Phillies and the Astros, I think we just have to wait for more time. Okay. You know, Josh Hader is not going to be blowing saves all year like he did on Tuesday night. What's interesting is that I'm sort of living this whole thing about overreaction. I haven't told you this, Taylor, but Jake and I, my son, we have a fantasy team in an ESPN league. Mm-hmm. And he, just every day he wants to make massive change. We have Aaron Judge on our team. Okay. Aaron Judge. And Jake is like, Aaron Judge is not picking. He's not carrying his weight. I'm like, dude, don't even think about it. Don't even think about it. And I reminded him that I think that Judge, in the year in which he broke the home run record, he had his first home run like April 28th. I'm like, you know, you got to be a little bit patient in baseball. He dumped Mitch Garver. And I told you he's a Braves fan. And picked up Travis d'Arnaud without talking to me. And Whoa. Here's Mitch Garver, one of the best offensive catchers in baseball. And I just said, dude, don't ever, just promise me, don't make transactions without talking to me, because I know a little something about what's going on.
Wow, a schism in management right now. Brutal amongst family yeah, members.
I feel like it's a Jimmy, you know, Jimmy Johnson and what's the name of the Cowboys? Jerry Jones, you know? I mean, that's the way it feels right now. We got a little oil and water right. situation going on with Jake and our fantasy team.
Oh, my gosh. All right, last one for today. Andrew C. at the Sports Snob. He writes, in the Orioles elected to send Jackson Holliday to the minors so he could develop at second base, left-handed pitching, yada, yada, yada. He writes, in what's his best defensive position? Does he have the ability to play shortstop in the bigs? What's his best defensive alignment for the O's? And I have to mention, yawn, he hit another home run last night. So did Kyle Stowers and Connor Norby and Heston Kerstad. All the AAA guys in Norfolk. No big deal.
Yeah, I look, he should have started the year. They should call him up today. He would be a second baseman for them. By all accounts, from talking with people, it sounds like Gunnar Henderson right now is a better second or better shortstop than he is. But that's his natural position in shortstop.
He could probably play third base. They could mess around with him and Jordan Westberg and Gunnar Henderson. They would make it work very easily, I promise.
I don't know. I promise. I mean, it's the same thing I said about Paul Skeens of the Pirates. Is he one of your, you know, 12 best pitchers? Yes, he is. And is Jackson Holliday one of your best position players? Yes. And give him a chance to grow in the major leagues and to win. Can you imagine if they keep him down the minor leagues and they lose, you know, a playoff spot by one game, Taylor?
Oh, my God. That would be horrific. I'm in a huge fight with one of my friends right now over text. My buddy Max, he is like a blind Mike Elias, you know, follower. Which Mike Elias, again, amazing GM. He's awesome. But like... The unwillingness to play the young guys is what rankles us over here. And my buddy is like, just trust the process, man. Trust the process. Like, let's play the best guys. Come on.
I know. Right. Yeah, I agree with you. Mike Elias done a great job of picking players. But, you know, they punted on the 2022 season, missed the playoffs by, what, 2 or 3 games?
Right. Exactly.
Then, yeah. And then, you know, last year they got knocked out in the first round. You know, to this point, how many playoff wins?
Zero. I mean, the AL East, you know, division banner is nice. You know, that placates most, including myself. But we can pick nits over here. That's not a big deal.
Of course. That's exactly right. And I would say, too, you know, I know that no one over there is going to say the word tanking out loud. But, you know, once you engage in that sort of practice, then everything's on the table in terms of what you might do. Right. And yep. So I have no problem speculating that this is service time manipulation based on the fact that they tank for all those years.
Since you opened the door here, there was a report yesterday that, you know, the operating money that all these baseball teams made and not the full picture.
How about
the
that?
Orioles have made more money than anyone in the major leagues over the last
of
couple years.
Of course they have. That's what we were saying
That's
all
along.
That's
all we say it all the time. That's all we say. Everyone's like, oh, you guys hate the Orioles. You hate Mike Elias. No, we're just speaking truth over here, Buster.
Right. We're pointing out the fact that when you tank, it's not only about getting good access to good players at the top of the draft, but it's also about hoarding money. And according to that Forbes report, That's what the Orioles have done. So you know what? Spend a little and call up Jackson Holliday. Put him in the big leagues.
Let's do it. Do it tomorrow. Ramon Urias, great bench piece. Tony Kemp, bye-bye.
Oh, man.
That's it.
All right.
Goodbye.
Okay, that's it for today. My thanks today to Paul Ambikides, to Dieter Rule, and to Grayson Rodriguez, who made Taylor's day by complimenting his hat, and my thanks to Taylor as well. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.